Welcome back to Community Voices, and we're pleased to have with us as our guest right now, Sebastian Younger, and no doubt you already in Park City know Sebastian and his work, because he's been here a couple of times for Sundance, most recently with his film Restrepo, which won the Grand Jury Award at the 2010 Sundance. But primarily, Sebastian Younger is a writer, both for Vanity Fair and for books. The first one you will remember clearly is The Perfect Storm, which became a popular movie, and then Fire, about being in dangerous places and with dangerous jobs and that sort of thing. And that evolved into his newest book, War, which is just out in paperback. And Sebastian, welcome to Community Voices, and welcome back to KPCW. You've been a guest
Thank
here
you very
before.
Much. It's nice to be with you.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your career and what got you to where you are. Your themes run to dangerous jobs, dangerous places. Just danger is a theme in your work. What drew you to that aspect of journalism?
Well, I wasn't drawn to the danger in and of itself, but the situations that I was interested in often had a component of risk to them that I was sort of willing to undergo to cover the story. So, you know, I was in Bosnia during the Civil War there, and there was a certain amount of danger, but I wouldn't say it was enormous. But it certainly was a very dramatic situation. It was my first exposure to war, and I suddenly had because of that I had the sense that, like, this work of war reporting is so important, because the world doesn't know what's going on in places like Bosnia, Rwanda, Libya. The Western world won't have enough information to really make good and responsible decisions about how to deal with that stuff. So it felt like a very important role to be playing in current events, and I feel very, very lucky that I was able to do it for so long.
And the reporting you do is more in depth. Vanity Fair, multi-thousand word articles. Are you able to get to a point and tell a story in the kind of detail that is required for Americans, Westerners, to understand them? Is this it's a different level of reporting than a network news clip that runs a minute and a half, certainly.
Absolutely, and you know, it's all part of the journalism food chain. I mean, you do need the brief up to the second bulletins of developments in an important story, and then you need really thoughtful long form pieces in magazines or even in books that really go into the complexities of a situation, and you can't do all things in every piece. It's impossible. So there is this sort of like food chain of material that we do need to sort of digest all of it to completely understand the story.
And you tell the very human story of the men who are doing the fighting. This is Pam Wiley, by the way.
Yeah, what I wanted to do, after years of reporting on the politics and the strategies of various wars, again, most of them in Africa. I was in Afghanistan starting in the mid-90s. I really wanted to, at this point in my life, understand what it was like to be a soldier in combat. So I basically assigned myself a story. I was working for Vanity Fair, but I had this idea of being with a platoon, about 30 men, at a remote outpost in Afghanistan. I was with Battle Company of the 173rd Airborne in the Korangal Valley, a six-mile-long valley in the eastern part of the country. I was out at a remote outpost called OP Restrepo, named after the platoon medic who was killed early in the deployment. 20 men at that position. And I just lived exactly like the soldiers lived. I went on every patrol. I bunked where they bunked. I ate what they ate. They had no internet. They had no running water out there. They couldn't bathe for a month at a time. They had no cooked food. And they were in an enormous amount of combat. And so my book, War, is about not the strategy, not the politics, but what their experience was, the emotional reality, the good and the bad of being in that much combat.
And what you do is organize the book under three themes: fear, killing, and love. So obviously, living with the troops in the Korangal, you felt those three themes run together. That's the job.
Those fear, killing, and love were the three primary emotional experiences of combat as I understood them. Killing was a very obvious thing to do when someone's trying to kill you. Nothing's more natural. There's very little ambivalence about it. But it does present a complicated emotional territory for people who are engaged in that. And that can play out for years, I think, in people's minds. Love was is a reference to the bond within the platoon, and it's an incredibly powerful bond. It really is a brotherhood in that situation. And it is the thing that allows these guys, and it was all men out there, there were no women in uniform, it's the thing that allows them to overcome their fear and also overcome their, I think, natural human reluctance to kill other people.
And you pointed out how it was actually, it becomes a survival thing, because if everybody is working towards what's best for the group, it means that everybody has a better chance of staying alive.
That's right. If you have 30 people who are completely acting just within their own perceived self-interest, in other words, every man for himself, a platoon like that won't survive. I mean, everyone will die if they're facing an enemy unit that's well-organized. One of the men I was with said, you know, it's amazing. There's guys in the platoon who hate each other, but we'd all die for each other. When you get a group like that, functioning like that, you can employ tactics. You can, one squad takes some risks while another squad gets into position and then is in a better position to hit the enemy to get the first squad out of danger. I mean, like that kind of thing. It's a football game. It's a chess game. And if you don't have that incredibly tight bond, that the ability to maneuver like that completely falls apart, and you're basically dead in the water.
And did you understand how that bond is created by being with them? They're at the tip of the spear, and they're probably experiencing the most stress of any soldier in the U.S. Army or any army. And yet
the bond was a huge relief. You know, I mean, as I increasingly trip after trip became part of that bond, even though I didn't carry a weapon, but I became part of that bond. As that happened, my fear levels dropped. And I think it's a very natural human reaction to being in a situation under threat in a small group. We obviously, as a species, we evolved in circumstances very, very similar to that. And I think it's a natural human adaptation to that problem of external threat to a small group.
But that's what I have a hard time understanding, not having anything near your experiences. Why two guys who, as you say, may hate each other but will die for each other, why one will the example of falling on a grenade to save his buddy, knowing that it's suicide?
Well, think about the bonds of family, right? I mean, you could have two brothers who are in a terrific feud with each other, but they also know they're brothers, and they would not, I think in many situations, no one, doesn't matter what your immediate feelings are for your brother, you may be awfully pissed off at him, but you certainly wouldn't stand by idly while he was killed by a gang, say, right? I mean, you would do something. He's your brother. That's what happens in a platoon. Like, it duplicates the bonds of family with people who are not genetically related to each other.
And that's the whole thing, because if everybody's waiting around trying to figure things out rationally, everybody's dead. But this is the instantaneous going for the right decision that's going to protect everybody around you and not even thinking about it, just reacting.
If you love someone and you don't lift a finger while they lose their life, you will live in psychological agony for the rest of your life. And that's something that the guys that I was with had no interest in doing. I mean, they would rather risk their life trying to save their brothers than save their life and live in shame and torment for the next 50 years. Like, it's a no-brainer. I mean, it's not even a dilemma. It's very, very obvious what they need to do, and they do it.
And does it stand out more because it is all life and death? And because you make the differentiation between the combat soldiers and the garrison soldiers.
There's a huge difference between combat soldiers and garrison soldiers. I mean, the values the expectations, the behavior in combat are radically different from back in garrison. So in garrison, you really need a complete sort of almost obsessive kind of conformity in your appearance, in the way you conduct yourself. In combat, the details of, you know, whether you bloused your trousers and your boots or not were completely irrelevant, and the guys completely forgot about them. But they had enormous internal discipline. So they looked like hell. I mean, their combat fatigues were in shreds. And, you know, I saw them in firefight. You know, the outpost would get attacked, and they'd jump on the guns, and they'd be going through firefights in flip-flops and gym shorts on a hot day, you know, some of them smoking while they were shooting, and you know, completely outside of regulation. They looked totally ill-disciplined. From the perspective of a rear base officer, they looked completely undisciplined, but they weren't. They were amazingly disciplined. You just couldn't see it in their clothing.
When you have a platoon of soldiers, 20 guys living together for months at a time, and they are Army soldiers, and then they get word that some guy named Younger is a reporter and he's going to be embedded with the unit. I could imagine they might not have initially been thrilled. How did you wind up bonding with them and becoming part of that platoon?
Well, the first thing that they heard was that two Vanity Fair reporters were coming. And traditionally with the soldiers, not the officers so much, but the guys on the ground, there's a lot of eye rolling about the press. And so, no, definitely, they're not particularly thrilled at having the press there, but they heard it was two Vanity Fair reporters, so they thought it was going to be two young women. So
they were expecting high fashion.
Until we actually showed up, and they realized it was two middle-aged men. And so that was a huge disappointment to them. But then after that, I mean, really, it's like in anything, you get close to people through experience with them. And had we just done a couple of weeks and left, they wouldn't have thought twice about us, but we just kept going back. I mean, Tim and I did a total of 10 trips between the two of us, sometimes together, sometimes apart. And, you know, you just rack up that kind of experience. Tim and I both sacrificed quite a lot to be out there. We handled ourselves well in combat and everything else. And, you know, by third trip or so, you know, we really felt like we were pretty much part of the platoon.
And Tim is Tim Hetherington, your partner on several reporting projects and your co-producer on Restrepo, the movie. And we'll talk about Tim a little bit later because he died recently and it changed your thinking. And we'll get into that a little bit later. But first, let's stay with the theme of being there. And you write about how soldiers were bored and looking forward to being attacked, so they'd have something to do to get the adrenaline pumping. And one of the quotes that just stuck with me from the movie is talking to a soldier. He said, "You can't get a better high. It's better than crack. Once you've been shot at, you can't come down from that." You know, again, being never having been in war, I would think you'd want to come down from that and get the hell out of there and not look forward to the next adventure along those lines.
Well, you know, I think they felt like that their chances of surviving all this were quite good. I mean, no one embraces a situation where, you know, your chances of survival are you know, 10, 15, 20%. But that's not the case. And these are really well-trained guys. They had great confidence in their abilities. Combat tested their abilities and over again showed that they could defend themselves. And there is a real deep, I think, kind of human satisfaction in being presented with a problem, a threatening problem, and dismantling it and overcoming it. I mean, that is just a basic human response to adversity, and I think it's very powerful. And these guys really thrived on it. And you got to remember at this outpost, well, first of all, they all volunteered. They all wanted to be in the Army, many of them from when they were small kids. And not just in the Army, they wanted to be in combat. And they had to go to great lengths to be even get into the 173rd Airborne. You know, like, I mean, that was, like, for them, a huge, they made the football team, basically.
That was an elite unit.
Now, you had an experience where you were in a Humvee and a bomb went off underneath it. What was your reaction?
Well, yeah, we weren't in Humvees very often, but I took a supply convoy into the Korangal because the weather had grounded the helicopters for a while, and the Humvee that I was in was blown up by a roadside bomb. It was a pressure cooker bomb. It went off under the engine block, so we were not hurt. But it was really interesting. I mean, we were in a bad moment. It was a bad moment there. Like, we were, the Humvee was on fire, and we were taking fire, and we were kind of stuck in the Humvee, and it was filling with smoke, and it was just, you know, arguably not a good situation. And I was completely calm. Like, I had zero fear at all. And I mean, I was so calm and rational, I was adjusting the filter setting on my camera to compensate for the smoke. The fear came later. It was really interesting. It delayed by about 6 hours, and I had just horrific dreams and stuff after that.
Is that an effect of the endorphins, the adrenaline that protects you in a situation like that?
Yeah, I mean, there is a kind of, yes, exactly. I mean, we're evolved to deal with life-threatening situations. We're, you know, we humans evolved in a very threatening world, and fear is adaptive. It's protective, because it gets you to avoid dangerous situations. But once you're in a dangerous situation, it's not adaptive at all. It actually gets in the way. And so it's very interesting to watch how fear would work in me. I mean, I had experienced tremendous fear, anticipatory fear, before expected attacks, before dangerous patrols. In the moment itself, you're in this just kind of jacked up blur and very, very calm. At least I was most of the time.
And did you find
and then afterwards you would process it, and you process it in all kinds of sort of painful ways.
And did you find that your feelings toward the person who was trying to kill you became a little more personalized?
I'm sorry, say that again. I couldn't quite hear you.
Did you find that your feelings toward the person who was trying to kill you became a little personal?
Well, it's interesting. Like, combat's not very personal in the form that I experienced it. I mean, the guy, you know, we were getting shot at from 300-400 yards. You're shooting it. At that point, you're shooting at enemy, you know, like groups of enemy. They're shooting at groups of us. Like, it's not a personal thing. And you can do things to save yourself. You can get behind cover. What was sort of troubling about the IED was that it was a bomb that was planted in the road for us, and it was detonated by a guy who was a couple hundred feet away behind a rock, and he touched, you know, two wires together to a battery and detonated the bomb to kill us. And it became very personal. And it was the first time that I really, you know, like I said in my book, like, if I could have somehow personally killed that guy before he attacked us, I would have done it. And I'm not a soldier, I'm a civilian. I'm not interested in killing people. You know, I'm interested in understanding them. But in that moment, it was such a personal attack. I mean, you know, a few weeks earlier, an IED like that had blew up a Humvee, and a guy named Jesse Murphy lost both his legs. I was like, damn, that guy almost cost me my legs. Like, it was so personal, and the emotions in me became very personal. It was an interesting line to cross, sort of like in my mind.
Was part of that part of your feeling about when Tim passed on, when Tim was killed? Was this was a little more personal than covering somebody, because he was the person who had your back on everything and you had his back?
Absolutely. I mean, Tim was my colleague. He was my brother in the sense that soldiers use that word. And when he was killed in Libya, he was killed by a mortar shell shot by Gaddafi's forces outside the city of Misrata. And I think there's some reasons to think it was targeted at him and the other journalists he was with, and he lost his life in a horrible way. And we all know the phrase, the wrath of Achilles. You know, Achilles lost his best friend, his brother, in the Trojan War, and as a result, he went into a killing frenzy. And you know, soldiers fight for personal reasons. They really don't fight for government and for strategy and for politics. They fight because their buddy got killed, because they don't want their buddy to get killed. And I know I definitely felt the moment of that. You know, after Tim was killed, I mean, I didn't act on it, but the feeling that I had was, I now have a personal enemy in the Gaddafi regime. Like, it was the first time I'd really felt that.
And it reflects on a letter I believe you got from a Vietnam vet who told you Restrepo got close to telling the truth, but now you know the truth.
Yeah, Tim, I mean, the day that I got the terrible news about Tim, you know, later I got an email from a Vietnam vet who'd met us a year earlier because of Restrepo and because of my book. And he wrote to express his condolences, and he said, but I got to tell you this. He said, you know, guys, you guys with your books and your movie, you got very close to understanding the ultimate reality of war, but you didn't get all the way. He said that the core truth about war, the most important thing about war, isn't that like you might die out there. That's not it. It's that you absolutely are guaranteed to lose your brothers. He said, up till now, you didn't know the first thing about war, and now you know everything you need to know about it.
And by losing your brother, it's changed your perspective on what you've been doing for a living the last few decades.
That's right. I mean, I underwent this tremendous shock and grief of losing Tim, and I just the light bulb kind of went off. Like, I don't want the people I'm closest to go through what I just went through. And so I'm going to pull back from that kind of very frontline reporting and try to report on these very important situations and stories, you know, from a vantage point where I'm not literally getting shot at.
And you also have something else where you have basically an outreach on your website to veterans to help them out. It's kind of like you make the point that we have a responsibility to the soldiers who are out there in these outposts doing all these things.
Yes, I partnered with the IAVA and a wonderful group named TAPS, and they are, I mean, please go to my website, sebastianyounger.com, to find out more about them. But they are doing just heroic, important work trying to support veterans and veterans' families. Such important work. And, you know, I think as a society, you know, what we really need to do is, I mean, it's very easy to kind of compartmentalize war, and you sort of say, well, the guys are doing their duty, the soldiers are just, you know, they're doing their duty, or it's, you know, whatever. You can sort of phrase it in these kind of formal ways, but the reality of war is that these people come back, they have lost their best friends in horrible ways right in front of their eyes, and they have also killed people. I mean, some of them were people that were shooting at them, granted, but that still, there's a psychic toll that is born by that, from that act, which can be very, very costly. And so as a society, we don't want to compartmentalize that reality too, because that's the soldier's reality, and we really do have to kind of face it as a society. It'll help them tremendously.
But that's the great difficulty. They come back from the Korangal Valley or wherever they're in danger, and they come back to tree-lined streets of Middle America, and there's just such a disconnect between those two worlds.
There is, and there's. Thank God. I mean, none of them want there to be a closer connection between the Korangal and the streets of their hometown. I mean, that's, you know, like, they,
sure,
that's why they're out there in their mind, is they're fighting to defend those very tree-lined streets. They don't want them blended with the Korangal. But I think there is I think our society does need to, we need to open our minds to the full reality of war. And because the soldiers are forced to do that. And I think it's very easy, particularly in the political debate right now about war, it's so polarized. The left wing and the right wing, it's all so polarized. The truth is in the middle. And that's where we need to be to understand this thing. The rhetoric, really, the ideology and the rhetoric about war, both on the far left and the far right, is absolutely useless.
And unfortunately, there's been a long history of you revere soldiers and you like soldiers when there's a war going on, and the minute the war is over, mankind has generally turned their backs on soldiers, not trusted them, and et cetera, and refused to accept the responsibility of having their backs.
That's right. I mean, I think it's interesting, like 9/11 changed some things, and suddenly it became sort of all of our war in a way. I mean, I live in New York City, but I just know that there were, you know, the sons of hedge fund managers who quit their jobs and joined the Army. There were, you know, Yale graduates or whatever. I mean, there were people
from the football field
after 9/11, yeah, who joined the military. This never would have happened in the 80s or 90s. They joined the military because we were personally attacked. And so the demographics of the Army have changed tremendously since 9/11. So maybe in the wake of these wars, because it really was such an all-encompassing sort of effort, granted by a very small number of people, but the demographic range was extraordinary, at least with the guys I was with, I think maybe it will be a little different. I hope so.
Well, and especially with such a book as you have written, I want to thank you for that, for writing this book. I had a friend who came back from Vietnam, and he said, it was the worst time of my life, it was the best time of my life. And I always felt I understood the first part of what he said, and now, thanks to your book, I pretty much understand what he said about it being the best time of his life.
Oh, well, thank you. Yeah, that's what I really wanted to try to explain, is why do men miss war? If it's so traumatizing, what is it that they miss? Are they just so horribly messed up that they miss something bad? Or is there something sort of primal and essential going on out there that they come to feel they need, and then they miss it when they come home? The point of my book is trying to explain that to civilians.
We need to wrap up here pretty shortly, Sebastian, but let's get into a little looking into the future on Afghanistan as we begin to pull troops out of there. Is there hope that there's going to be democracy at some point? I mean, you have Karzai running the country now, but not especially well or honestly.
Well, democracy and stability are different things. Pakistan is not a democracy. It's not even stable, actually. India, you know, obviously has its issues. There's tremendous tribalism in India. Likewise with Afghanistan. I mean, it is a different part of the world than Wisconsin. I mean, let's face it. But that doesn't mean that we can't put in institutions there that respect human rights, that respect human dignity, and where there's a government that serves the people. Right now, the people are serving the government. It's a criminal. The Afghan government, I mean, there are many good people in it, but as an entity, it's basically a criminal syndicate.
And as long as it's like that, the Taliban can thrive, can't they? How do we
defeat the Taliban? What we need to do is, the Afghans will fight like devils when there's something to fight for. They drove the Soviets out. They do not like the Taliban, and I think they could easily drive the Taliban out back into Pakistan from where they came. If they were fighting for a good government, but they're not. And so I think ultimately to get out of there, what we need to do is to finally use the real leverage that we have to force Karzai to reform his government. And we haven't used that leverage, so of course he hasn't done it. It's not a military problem anymore. It's a political problem, and we're still not really engaging with the solutions that are necessary.
That sounds like what happened in Vietnam, where we were supporting a government that was not putting the people first.
That's right. I mean, I asked a senator who wanted to talk to me about Afghanistan. I said to him, like, sir, would you fight and die for Hamid Karzai? And he said, no, of course not. And I said, well, that's what you're asking the Afghans to do so that we can leave. We can't leave until they're willing to do that. And you wouldn't do it, so why should they? And he admitted that was true. We have to twist his arm. We can start turning off the billions of dollars of international money that are flowing in there. We can tighten that tap. That's a real source of pain for Karzai if we started to do that. And ultimately, we can threaten to pull out of the entire country if he does not institute very, very specific reforms, anti-corruption measures, things we've wanted him to do, and he keeps dodging it and prevaricating. And I think the time has come to start turning the screw and ultimately threaten to leave. If we leave, he's dead, and he knows that. I do not think he would call our bluff. And I think it's the one thing that actually really could save this project.
Well, Sebastian Younger, thanks very much for joining us. Your book, War, is now out in paperback. And, of course, Restrepo is available for viewing to see. And the book, War, is drawn from your experiences in Restrepo and elsewhere in the country, and we appreciate your being here, and next time you're in Park City, please stop by again. We'd love to visit with you on your future adventures.
I'd be very happy to. Thank you very much.